Greetings and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is your host, Reverend Juliet Nightingale. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences and related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests of both experiences and researches in the realm of NDEs and related topics. We do welcome your calls during the program for questions and input. Feel free to visit our website, towardthelight.org and towardthelight.info. Your support through donations are appreciated to support the organization and this tremendous radio program. And we also have got a myriad of resources and support available for people with near-death experiences. This week, I'm very pleased to have back on our show someone who was on our show several months ago and the author of a tremendous book, which I would say is a must-read, called Love is the Link. Welcome back to Toward the Light, Dr. Pam Kircher. Hello, Pam.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you back, and I've really, really been enjoying reading your book. And to give a little information to our listeners, you have, well, first of all, your fellow near-death experiencer, having had an NDE when you were a child, and also you've been a hospice physician, which is really a very powerful combination. And I noted in your book that you did point out something that is so true, that people who have had near-death experiences tend to want to do work that is centered on service to others. So I really look forward to talking with you about your experience and about your book. And I know there was also a recent, a rather small IAMS conference in Los Angeles that you attended that you wanted to talk about as well. So I guess what we can do, if you don't mind, is let's start a little bit by giving a little bit of history about your NDE and the writing of the book, and then, of course, we can move on to the topic of the conference. Got a lot to cover in this hour.
Okay. Well, in terms of my near-death experience, mine occurred back in 1950 when I was 6 years old. I had just turned six and was living in St. Joseph, Missouri, when I developed a sore throat that became worse over the course of a weekend and began to involve a terrible headache and dizziness. And by the time I went to the doctor on Monday morning, I had a stiff neck and was diagnosed with meningitis. And so that was the cause of the change in my health that led to the near-death experience. So what I remember is the incredible pain of meningitis.
Yes, I had that too, as a matter of fact. That's very interesting.
Uh-huh. Well, then you know how much that hurts.
Yes, I do. In fact, I was marveling at so many similarities when I was reading your book. So go ahead, love.
So I remember to this day that pain of the meningitis. And then suddenly I found myself out of my body and with the vantage point of being in the corner of the room. The pain was completely gone. And I felt, even though I was a six-year-old girl, I felt like I was neither an adult nor a child nor a girl or a boy. I was simply the soul that I am.
Yes.
And it was incredibly powerful. It felt absolutely real to me. And I felt that I was surrounded by God. It was certainly an incredibly peaceful feeling. And it was a brief experience, as many children have. Then I looked down and saw a little girl lying on the bed. I didn't first recognize that it was me, but I had empathy for her pain. And then suddenly it was as if my brain kicked in, and I thought, well, that's got to be me. And as soon as I thought it's got to be me, I was back in my body. And I had a decision to make whether or not to tell my parents. I had come from a Methodist background, and there was certainly no mention of near-death experiences, nor was that something that I'd ever heard anyone talk about anywhere. And yet, I was not the least bit afraid in the experience. It felt absolutely natural, and that it was truly a gift from God to show me kind of a preview of coming attractions.
I think that's a very important point you just made about the fact that it felt very natural to you, because through my different NDEs, I had the same experience. Nothing seemed strange or out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm. I never said, what the heck is this? It was so natural to me likewise. And you also mentioned that in your book, and I thought this is a wonderful, splendid point mm-hmm. to make.
Yes, because it isn't, and you know, one of the things that some naysayers have looked at as well, it means a little more if children have it, who have absolutely no experience with it, who have no one who's ever told them about it. They've obviously never read a book on near-death experiences if they're six.
Especially at that time.
And so it really, it helps to see what a completely innocent person experiences.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that, I think, you know, talking about childhood NDEs, and I'm both a child and adult NDE, that I think that really, really does carry a lot of weight because of the reasons you just mentioned. You know, what are little kids going to be exposed to in that regard, except our own deep communion with Source, which was indeed the case with me, and it mm-hmm. sounds like with you as well.
Yes, it was.
And so then, now, when you were out of body, you were talking about having empathy for the child
mm-hmm.
and with the child's pain. Did you actually feel the pain whilst you were out of body, or were you just in a deep knowing of the child?
It was a deep knowing. I wasn't feeling the pain.
I didn't think so, but I wanted to clarify that.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And so then, as soon as you acknowledge that must be you, then you were suddenly popped back into your body.
Right.
And then you
of course, the pain returned.
Yeah, boy. And then what happened after that? I know it's certainly, I'm trying to remember. Did you talk to your mom about it?
I did not.
Oh, that was many years later, wasn't it?
I'm sorry? It was many years later, yes.
Yes, okay.
I didn't talk to my parents about it. I felt like it would frighten them.
Yes.
They were only 18 and 20 when I was born.
Wow.
And I just felt like they'd have a kind of, this sounds silly, but a sheltered existence.
Sure.
And they wouldn't be able to have any context for an experience like this.
Mm.
And there was nothing in me that felt like I needed to have someone else to confirm my experience.
That's wonderful.
I knew it was real. I wasn't equally certain that I could convince them that it was real.
Yes.
And I was afraid they would try to do something to fix me mm-hmm. that would make me forget it. And I didn't want to forget it. So I never told them.
Well, you were clearly acting out of wisdom, and that's wonderful.
Well, and in fact, when I finally told my mother when I was 42 years old, she thought back on herself at that time in her life, and she said, I made a good decision.
Wow. That's really great. And
yeah.
So what, you know, where did that carry you from there? What, is that kind of what prompted you to go into medicine?
Well, I didn't know it at the time,
uh-huh.
because one thing about never talking to anybody about your experience is that it becomes a totally unique experience for you.
Yes.
You don't know what you have in common with other people who have had a similar experience because you don't talk to anybody about it.
Exactly.
And so while I wanted to be a doctor from as early as I can remember, and I don't come from a family of doctors, it might have had something to do with it, but I didn't know it in any concrete way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting, too, that you took on the challenge of becoming a physician in a basically man's world, and, you know, the medical community, and I commend you for that as well. And then, were you a GP for a while?
Yes, I
family physician, that sort of thing, right?
Uh-huh, yes. I actually, while I always expected to be a doctor and I was in pre-med when I was in college, I got married in college and we didn't really have the money for both of us to go to med school.
Mm-hmm.
And so my husband went to med school first. And then I worked his way through med school working in research and at the medical school myself. And then we had two children and life happened and then we got divorced, and it was after we'd been married 10 years and gotten divorced that I thought, well, I want to rethink my life and look for what were my dreams, not our dreams. And in looking at my dreams, I realized that I'd always wanted to be a doctor. So I actually started medical school when I was 30. And I had two preschool children. They weren't quite preschool. They were 4 and 6. And I was actually the first single mother that Baylor College of Medicine in Houston ever accepted.
Wow.
And that happened in 1975 because I had a great debt of gratitude to the whole feminist movement. I wasn't much involved myself, but it was because of them that graduate schools and medical schools could no longer discriminate against women based on their life circumstances. They had to have equal footing with men in getting in, and that's how I ever got in the first place.
Oh, wow.
I know.
That is great news. You've really been a trailblazer in so many ways and setting wonderful examples. I'm sure that you're a tremendous source of inspiration for people. You know, paving the way for things as we both know that were just not always available, especially to women.
Mm-hmm. Well, I knew when I was going through medical school that I was I felt like I was responsible for all the women, the single mothers who would want to come behind me. And I was very careful to have good grades because I didn't want there to be any question about the right of women who were single mothers to go to medical school.
Wow. That's really tremendous in your consciousness and being so aware of the fact that you were going to make a statement for many people.
Yeah. And in the same way that I was grateful to the women who'd made the laws change, I wanted to be one of those women making it easy for women behind me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I admire this so much. And then tell us, you finally obviously did become a family
doctor. I did. And I did become a family doctor, as you say. I was a family doctor in Houston for 8 years before I went into hospice work. And during that time, I did a lot of counseling as well. I had all my electives in psychiatry. So I did a lot of counseling while I was a family practice doctor.
Now, what was the catalyst that catapulted you into hospice work?
Well, it was an evolutionary process. In about 1988... it's probably 1987. I read Raymond Moody's book,
Life After Life.
Yeah, I read that, and it was my reaction was, well, isn't that interesting that other people have an experience like mine?
Yes.
But I didn't make anything more of it than that, I have to say. So it didn't impact me greatly. It was just kind of a curiosity piece.
Uh huh.
And then the following year, I read Ken Ring's book, Heading Toward Omega. When I read that book, which is a compilation questions that were asked of people about how their attitudes changed as a result of a near-death experience.
Oh, indeed.
I was blown away.
Because, I imagine.
Yeah, there I looked at it and I thought, oh, all the ways that I had seen myself as different from other people, and I'd been looking at psychological theories and all, it was a simple explanation for it. And that was that I had a near-death experience, and I was completely ordinary for somebody with a near-death experience. So it was totally life-changing for me.
Wow.
And then once I saw how important that was for me, I realized that I felt like I had a responsibility as a medical doctor to let other people know about these profound changes that happen to people with a near-death experience. So it was truly reading that book that made me, as you would say, come out of the closet.
Because
I never really intended to come out of the closet on that. I had never told a single soul, and I didn't expect to. And it was only because of that that I actually started talking about it at all. And at that time, I was 42 years old.
Wow. Well, you're still way ahead of me. It's really intriguing to me to know all of these people who did find out about all of this stuff in the 70s, in the 80s, and I didn't even find out about any of it until the 90s, 20 years after my son had an NDE. So I'm still a real newbie, but yet I'm obsessively into this work and feeling the responsibility, as you do,
yes,
to help educate and to help support and to help heal and all of this, just because it's huge. And even as Dr. Pen Van Lommel was pointing out on my show, bless him, he's tremendous, he said that this is the one experience that has the greatest emotional impact of one's entire life, and I couldn't agree more.
I agree with him, but I want to add that in my 20 years now of working in this field, I also believe that people who have a profound, spiritually transformative experience,
yes,
are just as impacted as somebody,
yes,
whose heart happened to stop beating.
Well, yes, and that's a very valid point, because you're right, I should not say just NDE, but any such powerful experience like that, absolutely, because I've had them all as well. And
yeah.
You're never the same once you've been through those experiences. And again, that's a good bit of news to remind people that you don't have to die in order to have such spiritually transcendent and transformative experiences,
mm-hmm,
not by any means. But it does seem that there have certainly been a lot of people at this point in the millions who've died and been brought back,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
somehow.
And of course, there are more and more people in that situation, because our resuscitative techniques are so much better.
Exactly.
So we actually have, in absolute numbers, a lot more near-death experiencers than we've ever had in the history of the world.
That's what I would think, too. That,
yeah.
Okay, you've just affirmed that. And I was really appreciating what you were saying in your book about the hospice work, too, because I feel, again, even though I haven't really had the opportunity to do volunteer within assisted hospice, as a result of visiting a hospice, I was motivated to write the article, The Dying Process from an Experiences Perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's so important to give people really solid understanding of what a dying person is going through. And I also am so grateful for the fact that you mentioned the deathbed phenomena, in other words, the deathbed visions, visitations, what have you, that are absolutely real.
Mm-hmm.
And now, are you still doing hospice work, or have you evolved into other things as well?
Actually, I'm not doing hospice work, Not specific hospice work anymore.
Okay.
I did go ahead and evolve into other things. I still do some talks about end of life issues, but I just recently spent 6 years working as the medical director of integrative medicine at our local hospital in Durango, Colorado. And during that time, we were able to bring in complementary therapies so that we could have a fully integrated hospital that included not only the best of Western medicine, but also the best of complementary. So we have now energy work and aromatherapy and affirmations and prayer and guided imagery and acupuncture and massage in our general, our little 72-bed general hospital.
Wow. That's what you mentioned that on the last show. Now I remember that.
Yeah, so that was very big for me.
That's tremendous.
Yes.
Now, are you setting up like a model that you can share with other institutions?
Well,
and get them to catch on to this?
Yes. What we've done is, we now really do have it fully integrated so that we do about 1,000 sessions a year that would include those things I just mentioned, plus minus acupuncture, depending on what people want. And in a 72-bed hospital, that is a huge number. That means for somebody in a 720-bed hospital, they do 10,000 sessions a year.
Wow.
So now the team at the hospital is doing consults with other hospitals through the country. And I recently spoke at Balance for Women Physicians conference where I told them about it. I told the other women physicians about our program. And from there, there's been some consults come in to use the skill set that they have locally in their own settings, but to have our team help them see how they can utilize their own resources. So they are doing that some.
I am so excited to hear about this because two complementary forms of healing that I do, I do Reiki, which I do know is started here and there to be integrated into hospitals. And then I'm also into something called Emotional Freedom Technique, EFT.
Mm-hmm. I know that.
I'm not certified in it yet, but I do plan to, because doing the work as the minister, as a counselor, doing prayers, and then doing this healing, I think it's really, really substantial, really important.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So I'm very excited about this work that you're doing. So I take it you are doing a bit of speaking, too, correct?
Doing a bit of speaking, yes. And I want to just add the other thing I've been doing a lot of in the last 6 years is Tai Chi for Health programs. I'm teaching instructors all over the country on these programs that are particularly for older adults, people with disabilities, people with arthritis, and people with diabetes.
Wow.
And so that has been a huge kind of missionary work for me because Tai Chi is one of those things that both balances the body and the spirit.
Yes.
And so I've really traveled all over the country teaching workshops, and one of the more fun ones I've done lately is I was up in Alaska this summer and taught a Tai Chi for Diabetes Instructors workshop to diabetic educators from 20 Inuit villages all over Alaska. And then they all took it back to their villages for the people with diabetes and those who were at risk. And so that's been really exciting for me, and I've done a lot of that in the last few years.
Well, let me know when you're coming to the Northeast.
I shall, yes. And to me, when we get back to near-death experiences, I think all the things that I've done that I'm just kind of talking with you about a bit are so typical of near-death experiences.
Oh, yes.
We're not, because, of course, when you innovate any program, you don't make a lot of money. The innovators aren't the ones. And so it's never been about money. It is always about service. And there's that sense, having no fear of death brings up so much ability to just have a free life.
Yes.
With
good
as
point.
Much creativity as you want. You don't have to be afraid of anything. And so it allows you to really think big.
And that's a really excellent point, Pam. And also it's interesting again to note that when we have these near-death experiences, we become very aware, either consciously or subconsciously, about the fact that we are multidimensional beings and dealing with multi-frequencies of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, coming back into this plane, a lot of our focus is going to be about integrating and using energy in healing.
Yes. Yes.
And not seeing things so linearly, if at all.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Not seeing them so linearly, and in fact, I have taught Tai Chi at some of several of the NDE workshops lately. You know, the national conference last year, and this time last week in LA, I taught Tai Chi in the mornings because it's so good for people who've had near-death experiences because it helps us be back in our bodies.
I was just thinking, it's grounding, right?
It's grounding. It is. It's just so good. People love it because we're so used to being so connected at higher levels, but we also have to be connected to the earth.
Yes. I know my daughter refers to me as a kite or a balloon. She says, I've got held the string, Mom, when you're going to drift away.
Yes.
It's so true. But yet I'm still grateful, for that and for the ability to balance things and to really make sense of a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As a result of having these experiences. So what else would you like to share with us, or do you want to talk? I know that you had mentioned that you wanted to share about the recent conference.
I did, and I want to share a bit about that. That conference was just last weekend, and in fact it was in Marina del Rey in California, which was the site, of course, of the fires.
Wow.
And we were not involved in the fires. We had the conference on Saturday and Sunday, and the fires started on Sunday, but they didn't really kick up until Monday.
For goodness
sake. Yeah, so it was a strange time.
Wow.
So that many of the people who were at the conference, or at least some of them, needed to evacuate the next day. So that lent a whole, eerie feeling to knowing, looking back and saying, oh, my goodness.
Yes. No, and you were aware of it whilst you were at the conference, correct?
I was not personally aware of it until right after the conference.
Okay,
because it started in Malibu, and that's far enough away that there was no smoke in the sky. It was an absolutely gorgeous day, actually.
I'm going to have to do a map and learn a bit more geography. Mm. SoCal, as I call it, is so much like its own country. It's huge.
but to give you just a flavor for what it was held in a beautiful park in a building that was almost glass, so that you could see the harbor and everything as
wow.
we were talking.
Mm.
And we did have it was. Small, but it was probably about 45 people.
Yeah.
But it was really wonderful because the theme of it was looking at all of the ways that an near-death experience impacts lives, and how do we really deal with it? So there was time for a lot of interaction among participants, and. I'd say a main theme that emerged was that while we are so eager to be of service to the world, we really can't do that well unless we take care of ourselves first.
Good point.
Yeah, that was brought up by several of the speakers, that we really have to be balanced and centered in ourselves before we can give to other people. And so that was a very big topic. In fact, it was the opening talk from Mary Kelly, who is a nurse, near-death experiencer living in Los Angeles, was just about that, about taking care of ourselves. And she, apropos of what you and I were talking about, she talked about using things like Reiki or healing touch to stay in balance. Meditation and yoga or Tai Chi, those things that you might imagine, and of course, eating well. So that was one very important one. And then another one I'd like to mention was the one that Yolaine Stout did on dating after a near-death experience. And basically, the whole thing was about relationships and how, as near-death experiences, we need to be mindful that our partners by and large, are not also near-death experiencers.
Right.
And that we really need to remember that for them, it is a frightening thing to think about their spouse as someone who loves the whole world about as much as they love them.
Mm-hmm. That's how I am.
Yes. And so that, you know, as compassionate near-death experiencers, we want to keep that in mind.
Yes.
Yeah, so I thought that was an excellent point.
And, it'd be good to find a way to not only educate ourselves about integrating in relationships, and I'm talking about any relationship, right?
Sure.
with our offspring, with friends and relatives. And it's kind of interesting because I'm an Aquarius, and I tend to have a rather detached nature about me. Anyway, you know, I don't seem to be emotionally attached and clingy and all of this. Just I've always had a more detached nature, and so my NDEs, I think, have compounded that. But it doesn't mean that we don't love deeply, because indeed we do, and
right.
Indeed we're capable of it. But yeah, there's just a difference in the way we connect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how we spend our time.
Yes. Yes, that, I really appreciate that, and I have asked Elaine, you know, will you come back on the show, because she's wonderful, and I've
uh-huh.
been thinking about her. Actually, I was sending Reiki to that whole region.
Yes,
and,
good.
Asking Beverly Brodsky and Dennis Purcell and Elaine Stout, let me know how you're doing. I'm sending you love and Reiki as I write this, you know. And I've gotten some good input that nobody's had to evacuate, nobody that we know anyway.
Oh,
so
good.
Far.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very pleased about that. So what else was covered in the...
Well, I did. I facilitated a session on when do we talk to people about our near-death... When do we talk to people who are dying about our near-death experience?
Uh-huh.
And... It was a fascinating preparation for me as I was thinking about it, because I realized that the truth of what I do is that when somebody's dying, I sit with them. I'm just present with them. And I let them lead the way with their own musings. And if they ask me what I think about death, I feel I'm free to say, My attitudes are colored by my own near-death experience, that I don't have any fear of death, and that they might be interested in knowing that there are some 13 million people in the United States today who've had near-death experiences, and by and large, nearly everyone has no fear of death either. And I usually leave it at that unless they ask me more. So I'm not someone who really is very... pushy about it,
yeah.
And I was delighted to see, as I was reading the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, that indeed Sogo Rinpoche says the same thing. He has a chapter on heart advice for being with the dying, and he says exactly the same thing, too, to not proselytize or lecture, but to simply be present. And I felt like probably that the most important thing we near-death experiencers bring to the bedside of a dying person is our own compassion and our sensitivity.
Mm. And our understanding.
Yes, and it's not so much that we can tell them about, oh, there's nothing to fear in death, because, you know, that's maybe deep-rooted for them.
Mm-hmm.
But we can certainly be understanding. We can certainly be compassionate. And those are skills that really are always jump started by a near death experience.
This is so in line with what I was saying in my article, The Dying Process, because I've got do's and don'ts in there as well. And it was actually inspired by the writing of the article was inspired by a nurse who wrote a pamphlet about dying. And I thought, well, this is a good start.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not from somebody who's been there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just hypothesis and observation, obviously,
mm-hmm.
from working with the dying. But I thought, okay, this is a great start, and I'm going to expound on this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
By writing information from the vantage point of one who's been there. And then I also talk about the actual transitioning and being on the other side, mm-hmm. in hopes that it can help make a lot sense of things that the caregiver and the loved one is observing in the dying
mm-hmm.
person.
Well, and as you mentioned earlier, it's so important for the loved ones to know that it is quite common to see deceased relatives.
Oh, yes.
Because if they think it's a hallucination, that brings up altogether different emotions than if they know it's natural.
Oh, does it ever. And that's what was so tremendous when I had Dr. Finnick and Dr. Van der Mill on my show, because they were both validating the same fact that these deathbed visions are not hallucinations.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Finnick was actually pointing out the differences
mm-hmm.
in an hallucination and DVV. And I'm forever grateful. I love it when new physicians, you know, from the sort of scientific perspective
mm-hmm.
can validate this because...
Well, you'll probably like my own little folksy story is when I was first seeing, I had patients in the inpatient unit, and it was not uncommon at all for me to walk in and have them be talking to a deceased relative I wasn't seeing.
Yes.
And so I thought, my first thought, like doctors would be, is, oh gosh, it's the pain meds I'm giving them. But then I thought, well, let me be a little bit more experimental about it. And so what I experimented with was when I walked in and somebody was talking with a deceased relative, I would excuse myself and interrupt them and say, you know, ask them what was their pain on a level of 0 to 10. And then I'd ask them what they were served for breakfast. And what I found was that they could answer those questions quite clearly.
Yes.
And then they wanted to go back and talk to the deceased relative, who had a lot more interesting things to say than their doctor did.
Yes.
But that is not the case with hallucination.
Exactly.
You know, people are having a hallucination. They are in their own world, in their own illusion. There is no way they're going to tell me what their pain measurement is.
Yes.
And so that was my own little unscientific study for myself to prove that it had nothing to do with the morphine.
Yeah, because the people still are they're very coherent. They're just, and this is what I call it in the article, they're toggling between the dimensions
mm-hmm.
simultaneously. So they can clearly connect with you and also simultaneously connect with the deceased
yes.
friend or loved one. Now, I'm curious, too, if you and or people that you've worked with in the hospice work, if you've had these simultaneous DVVs also, in other words, sharing in the DVVs with the dying person, also being able to see and communicate with a deceased friend or loved one.
Now, I haven't been able to.
Okay.
Yeah, I think other people do, but I haven't had that experience.
Was it ever brought up in your hospice work that you remember?
What the one piece I remember about it is that we had a couple of for one thing, I want to say we were very open about people having near-death experiences and seeing deceased relatives in my hospice, because I was the lead doctor at the
yes.
inpatient unit. So if the doctor says it's okay, you know, people talk about, oh, yeah, sure. So it was common when we had checkout rounds, that is between you go from one shift to the next, common for people to say, oh, so-and-so is seeing deceased relatives. Because what we knew was that once they started seeing deceased relatives, they sort of turned that corner.
Yes. Yes.
And it was an important part of good caretaking. So it was part of our checkout rounds for each other. I never heard one of the professional, the nurse or the other doctors, say that they saw the deceased relatives themselves. I did have a couple of volunteers tell me that, particularly, I'm thinking of one volunteer in particular who liked to sit with people who were already unresponsive.
Yes.
He could tell when the spirit left the body. It was like a, for him, he said it was kind of just energetically, he could feel it go out.
Oh, wonderful.
So I knew that occurred, which is a related thing. It's not exactly what you asked. But certainly for myself, when I'm with someone as they die, I can feel that time. I don't see anything. I don't see wisps of smoke or something. But I can feel when they leave. And what's left behind is the body and not the soul.
Yeah, it's just a shell, isn't it? Just like a piece of clothing that we are done with. It's our earth suit, as it were. And we no longer need it when we transition. And another interesting thing to bring up, too, for example, my huge transient NDE was as a result of cancer. So I was in a coma for weeks. And I actually flatlined on my birthday, which is
interesting. Oh, my.
So I can tell people I'm 31 and not be lying. But I think it's important to point that just because someone is in coma doesn't really mean that they're unconscious or unaware.
Right.
People make, and also at the same time, when someone is under the anesthesia in the operating theater, and doctors will start cracking jokes or doing whatever, and I want to say, whoa, be careful what you say, because these people are going to report back to you.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really truly unconscious.
And that does sometimes happen. Often people really don't remember anything from when they're under anesthesia.
Yeah.
But people do sometimes report that. And there is a difference in the amount of anesthesia needed if the person is, in order for them to be relaxed and asleep, if they're just in the regular ambiance of the operating room, versus if they're getting to use earphones that have either music that's significant to them, that's quiet, or guided imagery.
Wow.
And we always offer the guided imagery or quiet music via earbuds for our patients at the hospital that are being operated on.
Wow, so that is going on whilst they're in surgery then?
Right.
Oh, that is lovely.
So they will have prepared before surgery with working with the guided imagery. And then they take it, and you know, they've gotten really comfortable, and when they're using that before surgery, then their heart rate slows down, they relax. Putting those earphones on before the anesthesia is given then just allows them to go into that more relaxed state, and they don't need so much anesthesia. You know, they'll get as much as they need.
Mm.
But they don't need as much because they're not struggling against it, because they're already relaxed.
That is so.
And that means they come out sooner, they have less feeling of drugged over from the anesthesia.
Mm, mm.
It's really optimal.
Now, does the hospital you work at have a website?
Yes, it's mercydurango.org.
Wonderful. And does it have information about all of these tremendous...
Uh-huh.
Oh,
it,
great.
It does. It has, it'd be under the Integrative Care Services.
Okay. Why don't you spell that out for our listening audiences and for me, too, because
okay.
I'm not sure how to spell Durango.
Okay. Mercy, M-E-R-C-Y, Durango, D-U-R-A-N-G-O, dot, and I said, yeah, I think it's dot org. A nonprofit. I'm thinking, if it's not .org, it's .net or .com. You know.
Okay. Well, let's try .org.
I think so.
Because my website is also .org.
Mm-hmm.
It's tortolight.org.
Yeah, I think it's .org.
And you've got a website too, correct?
I do, and it's pamkircher.com.
Okay.
And that's Pam P-A-M, Kircher K-I-R-C-H-E-R. .com. And what I do on that website is I have such a good time with it. I write articles that I'd like to share with other people, and it's got my upcoming workshops and just various things of what I'm really passionate about. So I have a whole section on NDEs and a whole section on end of life and one on integrative care and one on Tai Chi, so people can go to the one they care about.
That's great.
And then I have my favorite, I think, is the reflections chapter, where I just put articles that, you know, something that I'm really thinking about, and I just want to see, you know, how the rest of the world feels about it.
Well, that's wonderful, and that's a great resource to have, and I want to start reading some of your articles, too, now that I'm settling down from the dust of having just moved house.
That's a big one.
Oh, that's huge. But that's why I like to put articles on towardthelight.org, not only that I've written, but that others have written, like PMH Atwater. And she's going to be on my show on 16 December, and we're actually going to talk about the typical behaviors that result after near-death experiences. So I think that'll be very good, because a lot of people, a lot of NDEs are still kind of in the dark about why they behave or feel a certain way. You know, they haven't quite connected all those dots.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, when people like yourself and PMH, and then, of course, I've got articles by Dr. San Lomel and Dr. Finnick.
Mm-hmm. Good.
I like to have all of these resources available for people, because there's still a lot more questions than answers, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've still got a lot of work ahead of us for helping to educate people. And you know, a big one to me is indeed about consciousness. And again, I really want to remind people that just because someone is in a coma or what have you, that doesn't mean that they're not aware, because certainly we are.
And the other thing I'd like to add to that came up at this conference last weekend is that often a deceased relative will die when you stepped out of the room. And people, without knowing that that's so common, often feel guilty, like they shouldn't have left. But sometimes there's such a pull and so much love, it's easier for them to die when you're not right there present with them.
Good point.
So not to worry if that happens.
Yes. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, because that was something that was really powerful for our people this last weekend. And I'm thinking of two other things I wanted to talk about.
Please.
One of them is that I did a documentary on, is there a soul that this spring, and it's just now coming out. It's a two-part documentary. The first part is called The Seekers, and the second part is called The Investigators. And when they're asking the question, is there a soul, on The Investigators, they look at three different categories, or things that would support the idea of a soul. One of them, of course, is near-death experiences, and that's the one that I am involved with. But the other two are reincarnation and some of those studies that Ian Stevenson has done. And the other one is on the mediumship and the wonderful, wonderful research of Gary Swartz.
Oh, interesting. Yes, because I'm a medium, too. And
yes.
In fact, I when we were talking, I was thinking about when I had visited with a friend when I was in Nashville. She was a volunteer at the Alive Hospice in Nashville. And so she took me in to visit her patient, whose name was Liz. And I just had this silent, loving connection going on with her,
mm-hmm.
even though she was pretty much unresponsive at that time. But then when she crossed over, I knew about it. And then there was another time where Liz came to me and was sharing some information, which I passed on to my friend Sunny, and I told Sunny about Liz, and it completely coincided with a special experience that she was having regarding Liz,
mm-hmm.
and so again, all of these things really aligned perfectly with each other, I'm very grateful that you're pointing out mediumship, because we're not. You know, we're not freaks. We're just tapping into these higher frequencies.
Exactly. And if I may, let me give the website for that one.
Please.
Okay, it's a www.secretsofthelight.org. secretsofthesoul.net.
Secretsofthesoul.net.
Correct.
Wonderful.
And that'll come out. It's not quite. Give it a week or so. Because
so
it's right on the cutting edge.
Is this an online video? What format?
It's going to be, actually, that's going to be the website for the video for
okay.
people to discuss the soul, and the people who are on the video will be, you know, just kind of discussing things back and forth via email on this website.
Wow. Wonderful.
So it should be really a wonderful, deep, rich conversation.
I will put a link to that on Toward the Light.
Great. Good.
For sure.
Good.
That's wonderful. Anything else exciting coming up? Cause
well, I wanted to back up for a second.
Okay.
Because it was so exciting, and I can't remember if I said it when I was on the show before, but it bears repeating. And that is when we had the, just about a year ago now, when we had the MD Anderson 30-year anniversary of research. We had 350 attendees at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. And when I gave, after I gave my talk on a 30-year perspective of, I had started medical school 30 years ago. And,
is that
you know,
where you studied also?
It was. I studied at Baylor, which is in the same Texas Medical Center.
Wow.
So it was coming home. And
yes.
It was at the culmination of 2 days of everybody talking to research. And I kind of just brought it together and saying that now is the time to educate the doctors and residents about near-death experiences.
Thank you.
And it was so great. And the part that was the best, though, was that in my question and answer, the doctor who was in charge of death and dying education of medical students came down to the front and said he would commit to having near-death experiences talked about in his classes, which is huge.
Oh, my goodness me.
And then another professor who was the professor in charge of the hospice and palliative care fellowship for people who are going to be the doctors in hospice,
yes.
He came down and said, and I commit to doing the same thing for every hospice resident who comes through here. So those are so huge.
Oh, my gosh. I'm tingling all over hearing
yes.
you saying this. This is
yes.
tremendous.
Because for us to know that when somebody actually, if every single person who had a near-death experience in a hospital setting, if every single person encountered a doctor who knew what the heck that was,
yes.
and how it was going to impact their lives, this could change overnight.
It absolutely could. And I remember, again, with my own experience, I did happen to say something to the doctor because I was just so high from the experience, you know. And straight away, the doctor said, oh, I think you need psychiatric evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that shut me down completely.
Right. And that was the old response.
Oh, yeah. And yet I knew that he was mistaken, but that doesn't mean that I wasn't crushed, and it doesn't mean that I wasn't going to just run and hide, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that you were probably not likely to say it to a professional again anytime soon.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Between that and talking to a friend of mine who was a fundamentalist Seventh-day Adventist Christian, and I am not Christian. And she told me, oh, no, that was a hallucination. So you can imagine that a dear friend and a physician, how they alone had the power to completely shut me down. And I also feel passionate about changing this
mm-hmm.
because I think it's vitally important that the medical establishment become aware that these are not hallucinations, that these are not freaks, that these are real and legitimate life-altering experiences.
Yes.
And I'm with you on this. In fact, every doctor I've spoken with, I've asked, how can I help? How can I help spread the word? How can I help, you know, do my part to educate the medical community? Because I think more time needs to be given on the subject of death and dying and near-death experiences.
Well, and they are doing more time on death and dying, in thank heavens for the Templeton Foundation, which has funded a course in spirituality for medical schools. And because it's funded, and that means that those grants pay for the professor who teaches the class and all, because it's funded, it is a course in spirituality is now a part of almost half of medical schools.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And, you know, it may not be required. It may not be a long course, but at least they're hearing that spirituality matters.
Indeed, it does.
And the meaning that we give to our illness matters. It's not just a matter of a mechanical fixing of a problem. This is not an oil change.
That is wonderful. Well, Pam, we've come to the end of this transmission of Toward the Light. It has been so wonderful having you with us this week, and thank you very, very much for sharing. We've been speaking with Dr. Pam Kurtz, who is a physician and a fellow near-death experiencer. And next week, we're going to have Mr. Stephen Riles on our show, so you'll want to tune in for that. Please remember that it is only with the heart that one can see rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. And also remember that only love prevails. Blessings and light to all. We will speak to you next week.